Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's October 15th, 2017, and welcome to episode 160 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, space. So, here we are. There are three retro computing regulars here today. I'm Paul Hegstrom in Boston, and joining me today, we have Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I am excellent. Hello.
I said Toronto in a weird way for some reason, but Toronto? It's Toronto or something, right?
We don't pronounce the second T. It's Toronto.
Oh, it's T-R-O-N-O.
We are a lazy bunch here.
All right. Joining us from Sweden is Jack Nutting. How are you?
I'm doing well.
All right. I seem to not be eliciting very much response here.
You don't pronounce the second T in Nutting either.
No, that's right. Just one T.
Just the one T.
Excellent. All right. Well, I'm also doing well, so I guess that's that.
Nobody asked, Paul.
Yay.
Okay. All right.
The problem is the listeners weren't in on the preamble here. They've missed the gold that happened so far.
Right.
So we're at episode 160, and we were trying to figure out what to talk about. To me, when I hear 160, I think, oh, A0, and which is, you know, and which is the space character on the Apple II. So this, I don't know. It's also something like LDX or something. I think it might be LDY or something. That might be the hex, you know, the 6502 instruction.
That sounds familiar.
Somebody look that up.
Well, all I know is when I think 160, I think it's the year that in Rome the manufacturer of soap contained grease, lime, and ashes. The start of a whole new soap. Obviously.
Of course. Well, as we were trying to figure out, like, what else, you know, like, so that was my first association, but apparently there's actually a Wikipedia page devoted to things related to 160.
And there's not a lot.
And it's actually very, yeah, SMS, what is it, like, the SMS limit was 160. I'm trying to simultaneously look up opcodes. LDY, not bad. Yeah, okay.
Nailed it.
Well done. Yes. So we were brainstorming for quite a while before recording on what could the topic be. Like, we came up with some ideas, not necessarily all great ones.
No. 160 is the sum of the first 11 primes.
Discuss.
Right. Exactly. Well, so I was the main, I think, topic was I was trying to think of something to do with space, but of course, even then, we are still just flailing around. So.
Space is big, really big.
Yep. There was a video I think probably most of us have seen, or if you haven't seen it, you can go find it. Somebody took a Macintosh portable up onto, I think it's the International Space Station, and ejected a floppy, so you can watch the floppy kind of fly across the room.
If I was bringing a computer up that high, it would definitely be an Apple III.
That's right. Well, I mean, like, weightless. I mean, like, that's the ideal situation to be using an Apple III.
Because then all the chips will just float right out. You have no way to drop it to seat them again.
Push 3 inches. Right.
Yep.
So we brainstormed on space ideas for a while. Space as in, like, making space for things. But we've kind of talked about that before. We've talked about collections quite a bit. We talked about making space for stuff. Space bar, like favorite keyboards. But, you know, how long could we we talk about that. I don't know. It's tough to come up with topics, listeners. Yep. I hope you appreciate the effort that goes into this.
Right. Yeah, and of course, like the favorite keyboards, it seems like that, or favorite or least favorite, that, you know, it's kind of an immediate dead end because everybody's got the same opinion, I suspect. Like, okay, nobody likes the Atari 400. Nobody likes the ZX81.
Or any sort of chiclet keyboard. Like,
right.
That's as bad on like the Coco I had. I had an original Coco. And that was just an unusable keyboard. Same with like the ZX81, like any of the little flat things. Terrible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep. All right. So.
Including, for instance, the current laptops made by Apple. I hate those little flat keyboards and those. So they've come back around again. Ugh.
There's still a little bit of I don't mind those yet. There's some motion, at least.
But
I think
it goes down into it. It's like flush, and you press down into a gap. It makes no sense to me because I need to feel the little bumps between them. Touch type is, darn it, and not a good one.
But more and more people are sort of, you know, typing on phones and iPads and stuff. So that really is totally
kids.
Back to the. I guess there's a click though. That
I
maybe
think the keyboard
helps.
On
yeah,
these new Macs.
It.
I think it's kind of vestigial in a way. At some point, it's just going to drop off. It's going to shrink down like the human appendix and be like, it'll be a weird thing still attached to laptops. Like, what is that thing for, Daddy? Oh, we used to type on that with our fingers.
Nice.
Now that we have brain input,
fingers?
We don't need that anymore.
What are those, Daddy?
That's right.
Well, imagine if your jar was a lot longer and made of meat. Ooh, I don't want to be made of meat, Daddy. Don't worry. We aren't made of meat anymore. I don't know where I'm really going with this. If you
space.
Don't give me a topic, I just ramble. I'm going to space.
What else? Space is a concern of mine just because, like, there's no place to put anything. So, I went to MIT has this, like, flea market thing that I went to earlier today and wound up...
And you bought it.
And, you know, so I went and just to sort of see what was there and came back with like three different Palm Pilot things.
Mm-hmm.
So in their nice boxes, which means like the nice sort of space saving aspect of a organizer is lost because the box is, you know, big.
And you're going to want to keep the whole box, keep the whole thing. So.
Well, of course, that's the only reason I got them is because the box is cool, you know. So I have an original Palm Pilot and an M105 in their boxes. Oh, and I got an Atari Flashback 3 in its box.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Box.
I should not go to these things. But,
no, you should not. But they like it when you show up.
Gotta speak and spell.
The crowd. You got a speak and spell?
Wow. In a box?
No box. Oh. But and the guy threw in a little plastic ET.
I like the idea that he would use it to chastise students. They come in your office, you're just like... What do you think of my essay? The cow says moo.
Yes.
And the cow would do better at this course than you are.
Write it again. I can't actually remember even how it sounds. I was going to try it out, but it requires 4C batteries.
Damn it.
That's a crazy amount of power. Imagine like what kind of device you'd have today that would need that much power. If the iPhone took that, it would run for like 6 months.
Yeah. Anyway, very cool.
Or maybe so, not, actually. I'm assuming C cells have a lot of juice just because they're large. But that's not true. Maybe they're terrible compared to even modern things. I have no idea what I'm talking about. Ah, that feels comfortable.
Well, I thought a C cell was just the same as like a AAA, except just long, it like lasted longer, right? I mean, like
yeah,
the voltage is
voltage,
the same.
But just more long-lasting of that amount.
Maybe
of
that's
voltage.
Why some AAA batteries, when they fail, they swell. They're actually like... taking on their final form as a C battery.
That's right. A C battery and a AAA battery's body.
Or if you overcharge it, it just balloons up to the next size.
Yeah.
That'd be all fun, right. If the if Tesla, if instead of being fancy, it was just like a giant-looking C-cell battery. It was just like a meter long.
Strapped on top of the car, preferably.
It would be the best. I would totally buy one, other than, you know, the $1 million they cost.
This is the triple Z cell battery.
So I like the show topic. Well done.
Yep. Yeah. All right. So
160, hard number.
All right. Yeah. So anyway, I guess unless anyone wanted to talk about the Y register.
Why? No, I say we get to the. Was there feedback?
Well, there was, let's see. So a couple of people wrote in. My notes are on this are a little flimsy, but So Andy wrote in. This is sort of on the topic to wonder about. Well, it's essentially why the Dvorak keyboard didn't take off more. But I think we know that. I think it's just inertia, right?
Right.
QWERTY, it's true that QWERTY doesn't really have much of a logic, except for the probably relatively true lore that it's specifically designed to keep you from typing fast enough to jam your typewriter. It is.
But once you've got a system, it kind of doesn't matter what it is. I'm not switching keyboards for the little tiny maybe speed gap or speed advantage Dvorak would give me, if anything. Mm-hmm. Nope, I'm out.
But I think you still, it's still an option in almost any modern system. But I guess if you did convert back in, 1987 or something like that, then you'd want that option to remain.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who use it. And, I know that here in Sweden, there's even a Swedish variant called Svorak that includes, the Swedish funny characters.
It has a dedicated Bork key.
Bork. No, but there are some, some hardcore nerds who are Dvorak nerds.
There are only hardcore nerds who use
Dvorak. They use Linux and VI.
That's right.
And Dvorak.
I've always wondered, how VI on Dvorak, do you have to then move, your fingers to totally, not only do I have to learn to type differently, I have to learn different spots of where all the commands are to do everything?
Yep. That'll show you. Good using God. VI.
But I thought, aren't the VI commands mnemonics anyway? Isn't it up, down?
Somewhat, maybe. But not entirely. So the main arrow key movements are all on G, H, J, and K. Just so you can have sort of all right there. But the rest of them are mnemonics. So I guess if you learn, yeah. But it feels like that would be just, if you spend years learning how to edit in VI anyway, and then you're going to try and learn to type in a different thing and use VI different.
I had there was the Palm had a, a graffiti area that you could do handwriting stuff on. And I had some sort of attachment. I'm trying to remember exactly how this worked. But it was basically a keyboard overlay that you could put on top of the, some area of the screen where if you installed the appropriate little extension or whatever, you could type. You could just type on it as a keyboard.
Mm.
Sounds familiar. It was I think quicker ultimately than at least my graffiti usage, and one of the options that you had, this is where I'm not quite remembering the name of it, but there was a special arrangement of the keys that you could get. You could have a QWERTY arrangement, or you could have this other one that was supposed to minimize sort of pen travel in English, which I worked at it for a little bit. I didn't get very good at it, but now that I recall, it was even more complex than that, because it's such a small space that I think there was a difference between tapping and if you went on a particular spot and then you went up, it was one key, and if you went gestures mattered.
There was really just the one key and 26 different directions you could wiggle it in.
Right.
Very good. Excellent.
Yeah.
The problem with the Dvorak keyboard, I think that any speed gains you get from it must be more than eaten up by the fact that you also have to pause every day to go online and defend the Dvorak keyboard.
Right.
So all that extra typing has got to slow you down.
Right. There's a certain absurdity to the fact that if it is true that QWERTY exists to slow you down, that we're still using it. But I don't know. You have to. It has to. We have to reset somewhere if that's going to stop happening.
Right.
Teach no, provide no children with QWERTY keyboards or something.
That is the weirdest political platform promise ever.
No, you cannot use daddy's computer.
Don't look at daddy's dirty QWERTY keyboard. I type with shame.
Yes.
When you're out in public, you got to put a hood over yourself and your keyboard so people don't see it.
Right. Okay, let's see. And so we also have another emailed feedback, which might My notes are, again, sketchy enough that I don't even know if it's from the same person. When I go back and look at the email, I will find that out. But right now, all I'm looking at is something that says that Andy wrote to us over email. This was back when it was September 25th, and this day in history had brought up the Microcomputer Machines of Canada MCM-70, which was introduced on September 25th, 1973. So however many years ago that was. Some not very round number, but 44. I think that's right. Anyway,
right.
It's a pretty cool-looking computer, and it's Canadian.
Yay! Yep. Right, made right here in Toronto.
Yep.
I'd never heard of this thing before, but it's hilarious to look at.
It's really, it is a very funny-looking machine. It's impossible to look at this thing and not see a face in it. It's just, I think it is just impossible. So
yep.
Everybody must go look at the Wikipedia page for this. I don't think we ever did determine what these things are, but it looks like it has like a single row display, which sort of serves as a monobrow. And then there's like what might be two cassette decks.
They look like they flip up. So
yeah.
I think it's two cassette decks, although it gives it the look of a face of somebody wearing those slitted goggles so that you don't get snow blindness. So maybe that's what makes it a Canadian computer.
Yes, I'm sure that's what it is. Alternatively, if there's some way to eject them both at once, you could do one of those sort of like, what's the guy's name? The CSI Miami guy.
Yeah! Or this thing could just wink at you if just one of them went. It's like, why are you winking, computer? It's one of the most face-looking computers I've ever seen. Hard to think it would even be not on purpose. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
It's weird. So, and it really just has that one line for the text. Like, it's just, I don't know, it's looks like a bizarrely useless computer. I guess it was 74, though, so.
If that, I would love to have one of these. If anyone has one, the keyboard is specifically designed for APL. It looks like, you know, it has it's a QWERTY keyboard, but it also has all the sort of like Greek nonsense on it as well.
So it actually says it's
Paul,
actually
about his comment.
Part of the origin or the reason for creating this was because they wanted to make a machine that specifically supported APL. So it's like this is kind of like making a Lisp machine because you want to program in Lisp. The guy who designed this is like, okay, I want to have a great, simple little computer that will work with APL. And so they made this thing, and it cost $9,800.
My goodness.
Yep. And also, it's something that will, you know, lighten the mood every time you look at it.
When it winks at you. Every time you make a mistake.
Yeah, there should have been some sort of like like a paper output that would come out the space bar or something so that it would...
Like a tongue,
yeah. Though I suppose it's, you know, if it's Canadian, you want to keep your tongue inside.
Yes, please. My computer is stuck to the post.
Yeah. Anyway, so I didn't know anything about the MCM-70 before. I was glad to have had it brought to our attention.
Yep.
So, all right. Well, this train is moving quite nicely down the tracks. So we'll move on now to the items of interest in news. And Carrington, you have the first one.
WozU has been launched. So Steve Wozniak, you may have heard of him, has launched a new startup. And it is basically an idea to... It's an online training site specifically targeted at tech things. So you want to learn to program or something like that, you can enroll in WozU. It will be both online curricula and also they're going to be opening actual physical locations, it looks like, in the States. It says over the coming years, WozU will set up 30 brick-and-mortar locations around the U.S. to expand its digital institute into the physical world. Woz has always been into teaching, into school stuff, and one of the pitches here, although they have not announced what the cost to enroll will be, is that Woz says it's too expensive to learn these things. And so I think one of the goals is to make it quite inexpensive to enroll and then graduate from WozU. So the site is currently available online. You can take a look at it there. If you look at the curriculum page, at the moment they have two that you could explore. There's the computer support specialist and software developer. That's it at the moment, but the goal is, I think, to have more of them. And if you go to the site, there's a big old WAS head that's talking to you, but nicely it starts off muted, and so you can unmute, and that means you just missed the very beginning of what he's saying. Oh, autoplay. It is that. But yeah, so it's interesting, called WASU, definitely, you know, leveraging the WASness of it, and we'll see what happens.
Interesting, yeah. This reminds me that there's a Facebook group that's devoted to the Apple II, and you know, it's unbelievably active, but somebody had posted, I think, just a day or two ago, a photo of, I think, WAS going to some, there was some museum, it might have been in Poland or Russia or somewhere, that WAS had gone to and kind of like, you know, had his photo taken there visiting the place. And what was the cool thing about it was that, so the photo was posted by someone at the museum and there was comments and people liking it and, you know, and WAS himself came and commented on the thread as well, which is pretty wild.
Yep.
So he hangs out there. I imagine he probably doesn't see everything that happens there because, oh my gosh, does a lot happen there. But it's almost too much to keep up with there. But very cool that he's, you know, he's on Facebook and participating. All right.
Cool.
Enough of that. Jack, I don't know what this is. Tell us about it.
I've seen this a number of times. I keep meaning to mention it. There is this cross-platform game called Cross Chase. It's written by a guy named Fabrizio Caruso, and it's open source. It's on GitHub. And it's interesting because it's available for just a ton of platforms. Like, the idea seems to be, okay, he's writing this in ANSI C and compiling it for 6502 targets and for Z80 targets and also doing some work for 6809 targets. So the list of platforms that there are releases for is, I don't know, it's 2 or 3 dozen downloads ready to go. So it's interesting because I think, you know, we've had discussions at various times about about what cross-platform means and what it meant. And it's interesting to look at someone who's doing something that arguably at the time, back in the 70s or 80s, would have been nigh impossible. Like, there weren't good C compilers for all these platforms. But it's like here, so this is just like, to pick a few, looking at the downloads available, there's, of course, Apple II, something called the ACE, I don't know what that is. Aquarius, Atari, Atmos, Commodore, a variety of Commodore machines, all the ones you can think of, MSX. And then he's also got some consoles in here. So there's the NES, that's of course Spectrum, PET, just a ton of things.
Yeah, and looking at this list, you're right, it's huge. It goes on and on and on. I keep thinking, yep, yeah, on that as well, on this, on the MSX, on, wow, it's on everything.
Yeah. So it's very cool.
How many times do you see something that's being released that can run on the Apple II, the ZX81, the all the Ataris, and the Aquarius.
Right.
Okay.
And a pet.
Cool.
And so if you look on YouTube, there are a few videos showing the gameplay of this. And it's, you know, it's nothing spectacular by today's standards, certainly. And maybe not even by the day's standards. It's mostly character graphics. Like, there's no sprites involved or anything. But that's, you know, that's good for what it's doing because it means that it's, you know, easy to port it to more platforms. So it's, I don't know, I've not played this yet. It keeps popping up on one or another Atari groups that I'm on Facebook, and I keep meaning to mention it, and now I finally have. So,
well, the game itself is basically, it's a Doctor Who game.
Yeah.
Like one of those walk away and the Daleks chase you. It's essentially that concept.
Yeah, it seems to be that, but there seems to be some shooting involved also, which I don't think...
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah.
A little period, you know, goes across the screen.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's similar to like the kind of Daleks game, but different also. But I haven't played it yet to really know what the difference is. But anyway, kind of fun. And if you want to, you know, get your feet wet jumping into something for your favorite platform, well, here's a nice project all ready to go.
I'll have to try that out.
What would be fun is Paul could actually run all of them.
Yeah.
In your office.
Simultaneously, yeah.
Get simultaneously running on all of these targets.
Get a big stick with multiple orthogonal sticks on it so that I can type on all the keyboards at once.
Perfect.
Yes. Well, yeah, and I suppose actually the you know, I'm not sure how the random numbers work, you know, but the AIs might not be quite the same on each one, you know, so it might actually, right. Might not work to simultaneously control them all.
It'd be more fun to make them battle each other. They should play the game, but control the character on a different computer. And the idea is to keep your character alive longer than the one on your own computer.
Yeah, it would be sort of interesting to try something like that. Like have each of several players on the game field controlled by different machines. All right, so I have... This is not news in the sense that it's captured on the Wayback Machine, and it's an article from March 11th, 2008. But it was pretty cool. It was kind of an interesting idea. So it's called the Infinitely Profitable Program, and it just came to my attention somewhere. It's sort of going through talking about this person who was working at, I think, Taitung, the makers of the Einstein, which is a little CPM machine. And it's describing the kind of computing environment, but also it's a description of this program called Go.com. And it is the reason it was called the Infinitely Profitable Program is because this is a zero-byte program. maybe he got paid for it. If he did, then it's infinitely profitable.
Well, that was the point. He sold it for $5. So.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I missed the
yeah,
number
it was
part.
$5 a sale, and so technically that makes it infinitely profitable.
Yeah, which is and the idea behind it is actually really pretty cool. So it had to do with basically how you load and run things in CPM. And so there's like a particular address, I forget where it is, but it's mentioned somewhere. It's like 800 or something like that, where like a program will load and start, and then, you know, if you want to, then you go back to some sort of like command line, and if you want to run the next program, then you load it into that position and you start it. But the thing is that if you wanted to just go back to the same program you just ran, it would still be in memory. You wouldn't need to load it again, except that there was no way to do this. And so what Go.com does is it's basically a zero byte program, but the way CPM runs it is it says, okay, load those zero bytes and then jump to the start location, and the start location still holds the program that you loaded last. So it actually has a real function, which is pretty cool. But you know, it actually, the fact that it is 0 bytes long actually means something. Oh yeah, 100 hex. So anyway, I thought it's a cool concept and a clever little article. Mm-hmm. And so since I'd never come across it before, I thought I would highlight it.
Cool.
Excellent.
All right. Carrington, you have the next thing.
Well, on that Facebook Apple II enthusiast group that I'm never on because I don't want to log into Facebook, but I know I'm missing out on so much because so much stuff happens there. One of the things that happened there was Mike Westerfield of the ByteWorks announced that he has made the source code to Orca C and the Orca Lib library available on GitHub. So it doesn't mean that it's been released where it's now freeware or whatever, I don't think. But it does mean that everyone can look at it. It's going to be open source, and he can incorporate, you know, bug fixes and things that come from the community. So it is available now. You can head over to GitHub. We will have a link in the show notes, and you can download yourself the Orca C compiler and go to town.
Cool. I never used that.
I never used it either, but I want to take a look at this. Yeah.
Someday, but it is very cool that it's available, and it's also very cool that, like, I mean, this was a major development tool for people back when it was relevant. So it's cool that it's still actually being, you know, like people are still paying attention to it. The author is still there, you know, making it available.
Exactly, and that it can be updated or what have you if bugs are found. So I think it's really cool. So I want to give a shout out to that, and it is now currently available.
Excellent. Okay, Jack, you have a badge from VCF. Midwest. Oh, when was that?
Yeah,
when
so in that? September recently. Was the VCF Midwest, wherever that was held. I actually don't know where it was. It was somewhere in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And yep. They had a project for making a badge with a little scrolling text, LED text on it, powered by a 6502.
Cool.
So this is I'm just linking to a video that is a walkthrough of someone sort of looking at the manual and talking about what they're doing and going ahead and assembling this thing and hooking it up and testing it by outputting a program to it and having it run and display something on the screen. Pretty nifty, pretty neat idea. Mm-hmm. Powered by a few batteries in the back. Seems cool. Seems like a fun, and fun thing to build.
Put it, like, rub it on your sweater and short everything out.
That's right.
Static electricity. And... Excellent.
What I like about it is it's like a badge. You can get a lot of those nowadays. You can go and buy a badge that you can program through USB or whatever, and it'll I see a lot of trade shows, and it'll scroll across the message. And what's fun about this one is it is that same sort of display badge with a whole bunch of other stuff attached to it. So just hook up this giant thing to your shirt.
Right.
And that's the most fun part of it.
Yeah, the screenshot that I'm looking at right now is as the LED display says badge, in the best way it possibly could.
Right.
I guess with using lowercase letters. Yeah, it's all sort of variants of B's and nines.
Yep.
Badge
do what you
basic
can.
V1.0. That's pretty cool though.
Yep.
We're zooming through the news here. I'm seeing.
Excellent. But,
oh well, that's all right. The last time was very long, so.
Well, I can slow us down by saying I recently learned the etymology of lowercase versus uppercase, which I never knew before. Because I, you know, capital letters and things, and right. It turns out it was like in printing, when you have the little pieces of metal that you'd stick in a press to lay things out, there, it's a big case, and the capital letters and that sort of thing were in the upper part of it, and the smaller things are all in the lower part. So it's literally referred to as uppercase letters and lowercase letters.
And, of course.
And it has stuck. Yeah.
That makes total sense now that you say that.
And I never knew that before. I was like, really? Cool.
Yeah. The operation of those old printing presses is pretty astounding. Mm. Okay, let's see. So I have, I feel almost bad putting this in here because I'm scooping a different podcast that I would be otherwise talking about this on.
Wow.
But I figure this is probably, it'll be a while before we record that, and we'll go into it in more detail there. But Rob Justice, just like, you know, I think yesterday or something, 2 days ago, posted something on his blog that about an investigation he did into Apple III VisiCalc. So he's trying to make a copy of it, essentially, and try to look at what the copy protection mechanism was. And so he has some physical disks, and he also was working with the emulator and was trying. He imaged the disk, and the disk image did not start on the emulator because it's copy protected. And so he sort of looked around in it, and there was at the time there was a program that you could get from a company called On3 that would, it was called the Uncopy Protect driver, which was, you know, because you want to back up your programs and DRM is bad and all that. So they sold this thing that you could use to allow you to put the thing on your hard drive or make backups and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's not source code, but there's, you know, a program that will unprotect VisiCalc. And so Rob was kind of looking through this and tracing it through the debugger and stuff, and he sort of talks through it. But the sort of interesting punchline about this is that it appears that VisiCalc was making use of something that the operating system made available. Like it turned out that it was a totally standard operating system function that allowed it to be protected. This way, you know, it basically has to read some precisely positioned stuff on the disk and use that to decrypt the you know, some other part of the program. So this was actually Apple sanctioned, you know, there's hooks in the operating system. And as far as I know, like nobody knew this except for, you know, some high level developers in Apple. So that's, I mean, I think what the coolest thing about this is just that it's pretty much a new discovery, you know,
and it's crazy. I had never even heard that SOS had basically copy protection built into the operating system. Like that's, I've never even heard a rumor of that before.
Yeah, there's a sort of oblique reference to this in the blog post that there was 6 months ago or something. Sometime not so long ago, somebody found a bunch of like Apple documents at a Goodwill or something that were sort of outlining some discussions about sort of DRM.
I remember that. Yeah, we talked about that on the show.
Yeah. So I forget exactly, you know, what the ultimate thing was, but there were memos and stuff, and the acronym was SSAFE. So it might be that this is kind of that discussion might have led to this, you know, this stuff in SOS. But anyway, yeah, it was it's interesting to read, and it's And I think it's just neat that we can still be discovering stuff, you know? I mean, like, mm-hmm. obviously somebody knew it because somebody had to write it. But, I mean, like, you know, some small set of people within Apple were the people who knew this before.
And this is exactly the kind of thing that could have never been discovered and just be lost.
Yeah.
Like tears in the rain.
Right. Or, like, the stuff we said before we started recording.
Right.
Yes.
All that good stuff.
We had 160 good ideas.
Yeah.
Well, as someone who is not really steeped in a lot of Apple II knowledge, can someone tell me what SOS is?
Oh, the sophisticated operating system. It is the Apple III operating system. It's like it's like DOS or whatever.
Okay.
On the Apple II, there was initially a DOS, and then there the Apple III SOS was created, which had a lot more sort of modularity and stuff, and you could, you know, it had drivers and things like that.
Right. Okay.
Apple III kind of didn't go anywhere, but a lot of the guts of SOS was then taken into the next Apple II operating system, which is ProDOS.
Okay.
So.
Which I still think is a bit newfangled for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and
still can't get my head around having to type massive long directory names every time I use it. I don't know. Bugs me.
Yeah, that's one thing that it introduced hierarchical directories, but the downside is you have to type all this stuff. So I hate using it for the same reason Charrington does, because you're typing all the time. There's no tab autocomplete or anything. It's just type, type, type.
You got to switch to Dvorak.
Yeah, that would speed me up a little.
On my Canadian computer with the squinty little eyes looking at me.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So I guess that's basically it for what we had down in the news. There were a couple of other things that happened. I might just mention the Skolsky Apple One that we talked about in an episode or two ago. It sold for $401,000, which is, but it's not very much compared to like. I mean, like,
compared to, and for that quality of one too. So
yeah, I think when we were talking about it before, I was just amazed at like the awesomeness of this, you know, like all the stuff that came with it and then the condition it was in, and it, you know, it's got like whatever that is, like under half what they've gone for before.
I think we have long since reached peak Apple One.
I think maybe the Apple One has jumped the shark.
Yeah.
Sad.
Too bad. Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate for the person who sold it, but I mean, you know, $400,000 is
I got $400,000
okay
for
too.
A potentially useless computer, whatever. Cry me a river.
Yeah, right, exactly. All right. Okay, so I guess we can leave the news there and go now to a word from our sponsor.
The Apple One.
Yes, right. okay, let's see.
The Apple IIc and money.
People in high places are always asking me, Alan, where does the money go? If you wonder the same thing, I suggest an Apple IIc, an Apple modem. Then you can call up your bank and see how much money you have. You can even pay off your bills automatically. If you have any money left over, congratulations. You're doing better than the government is.
The Apple IIc. There's no telling how far it can take you.
And we're back. So today's the retro computing gift idea. This is Carrington provided this.
Oh, don't blame me for this one. So
it's. I do not yet really know what I think of this, but here it is. It is the 8-inch floppy disk notebook. And I mean, yeah, you know what it is, basically, just from my having said that. But it's a notebook that has as its cover an 8-inch floppy disk. And it's kind of cool. Come to think of it, like, it seemed kind of cool, but it seems like the kind of thing you would just put on a shelf or something or on your desk and, you know, have as a conversation piece, because the actual media with the window and everything seems like that would actually be fairly poor as a cover, now
right.
that I think about
yeah.
it.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, because it's... And you can get them in all different sizes. And maybe actually the 3.5-inch one might be slightly more usable because it's actually got a hard
case. It doesn't have a hole
case.
In the middle of the cover. Right,
right, yeah, and like a weak spot.
But what would be fun, though, since these are just recycled, used floppies, you can get 3.5, 5.25, or 8-inch floppies, is to get some of these, rip off the covers, and see what's on the disk.
Yeah, oh, that's nice. Yeah, a little like, you know... unsent confessions or whatever. I think actually even on the same site you can see some others that were made with 5 1/4 inch discs, and I just looking at them makes me cringe a little bit, because it's like, all right, well, what if that was the last,
right,
the last one?
Yeah, because they literally punch holes in the side to give it like a, I think it looks like a comb or a Sirlock binding.
Yeah.
To make these notebooks, I think it's a terrible waste of discs, but we were really stuck for a gift idea, and this is what we came up with, man.
Yep. So.
And they're cheap, $10 for the 8-inch one, down to like I think $6.50 or something for the 3 3.5-inch ones. So.
Yeah, get the 3.5-inch ones. There's, you know, like, first of all, 3.5-inch discs barely work anymore anyway. They're mostly all bad. And the other thing is that, you know, that's, it's past the vintage era. So we don't care.
No interesting software ever came on a 3.5-inch disc.
Yes, actually, I agree.
That's what we should, DVD, we should have like CDR notebooks.
Yeah, screw those things.
Anyway, yes. So, yeah, much cheaper, I think, than the last gift idea we had. This
exactly. $6.50. See, it's got that going for it.
Yep.
Nice.
All right. So, yeah, I think I have my mother at some point, I think, gave me 3.5-inch disc coasters, you know, for like
technically
setting drinks
on. 3.5-inch discs are coasters if you just use them that way. Everything's a coaster if you use it that way.
I think this thing was made into a coaster by adding cork to the bottom.
Oh, fancy. Yeah.
Yep.
Look at Paul and his fancy cork coasters.
Yes. All right. Okay. Anyway, so, and once you're done buying your floppy disk notebooks, you can turn to eBay, and Carrington will tell us the first thing to buy.
Don't buy anything.
Okay.
But if you were going to buy something, you could drop $500 on a probably non-functional printer. That is my choice. Why? Because it's a printer that rarely ever comes up, and I've always been fascinated by this thing. So it's the Apple Daisy Wheel letter quality printer. And what's fun about this, I love Daisy Wheel printers as is. I like the sound of the impact and the fact that you have all the fun clack, clack, clack like a dot matrix, but you get the nice crisp letters like it came from a typewriter. Really cool. What's neat about the Apple letter quality printer, though, is it could do graphics. Now, can't do great graphics, because one of the downsides to back then using a daisy wheel versus an impact printer, or versus a dot matrix, you use a dot matrix, you hook it up to your Mac, you get all these beautiful graphics, because, you know, dots on the screen, dots on the page, dots everywhere. Here we have an impact printer. Well, impact printers still can make dots, they can still make lines, and so you could send graphics to the Apple letter quality printer, and it would very slowly type them out. And you would actually get more pristine graphics than you could off, say, an image writer, because they are solid lines that are being typed, but it is very slowly typed, like it's like somebody with a typewriter basically typing out your graphic. And it's amazing and hilarious, and I don't know other Daisy Wheel printers that could do this, and it's really cool to watch. So this is one of them. They very rarely come up on eBay, which is why this is $500, and it's a barn find. Like they're saying, like, here it is. I found it at a barn. There's basically no chance it's functional. It's still $500. Crazy. Doesn't mean they'll sell for that, but it's very rare these things come up. We'll also have a link to a YouTube video, though, if you want to see this printer in action. Well, not this particular one, but a different model in action, doing the graphics, and it's really fun to watch because it's not the kind of thing you normally see.
That's cool. Yeah. I do not have one. I have never seen one in person. It's disgusting.
Yeah, I love
this. This one is gross. This one is filth. Literally, it says it's a barn find.
The baked in filth on this.
Yeah.
And there's a nice handwritten note taped at the top that says, please insert the paper slowly and carefully.
So even when it was working, it was barely working.
Right. Yeah.
Now, it has a serial number of 1,091, but that is a handwritten serial number.
Yeah.
So did it come that way, or just somebody said, you know what, I'm going to choose to give it this?
Yeah, I don't know what to make of that. It's interesting and strange that it is handwritten there. It doesn't seem like it's, like all the other lettering around seems to be okay. So I mean, it kind of looks like the label just didn't have a serial number on it, and then this was written on it. And maybe that's the way they were sold, you know?
It could be. And they probably started with 1,000, and this is the 91st of 100 that were ever made. I don't know. I wish this thing came out more often because I've always really liked it. I like Daisy Wheels anyway, but I like a Daisy Wheel that has the guts to try to do graphics. I'm like, very cool. You go, little Daisy Wheel. So anyway, the video is the main thing. It's really fun to watch the video of it actually printing out some graphics from a Mac.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah. So that is my choice. Although excellent. I wouldn't buy it myself because $500 for a barn-based non-working printer. I don't think so.
All right, Jack, you have a nice. Tell us about the thing you have found.
What I have is the amazing Atari Fossil Centipede watch. I think I may have talked about at some point that like I saw a news item about Fossil making some Atari-themed watches. But, like, at the time, at least, there was no, like, it was just like, oh, this is the thing that's going to happen. But there was no indication of what it was going to be. This seems to be, by the looks of it, it's a tiny watch that lets you actually play sort of some form of arcade-style Centipede on the watch. I don't have any indication.
Was it actually playable?
I don't know. I think it's supposed to be. I think that was the idea. But I don't know.
Depending on what time it is, though, different parts of the playfield are obscured.
Right.
It comes up, it's time to lose.
Yeah, or maybe it's just like you get a visual of the game playing itself as the day goes by. I don't really know. I think I love the look of it, though. I like the way the screen actually looks kind of like an old arcade game display in tiny, tiny format. I don't know if it's playable. I don't really know anything about it, but I think it looks kind of cool. It costs 70 British pounds, though, which means I'm not going to buy it. But, hey, if you got 70 pounds to drop on a watch, may as well drop it on this watch.
And it's new, comes with a case. I mean, you're not going to get one in better condition than this.
Yep.
Yeah. But so what I don't understand is, how long ago was this new thing manufactured?
I think it was only a couple of years ago.
Okay. All right. So it's not like from 1988 or something like that.
I don't think so. I think it's quite new.
Uh-huh.
I think this is one of the mini scattershot things that Atari has done over the last decade to try and put its name on things and engage with other brands and other sorts of products to try and stay relevant.
And I have just found on eBay, to add to this, a Fossil Atari Asteroids limited edition watch.
There you go.
So I'll add that to the intro notes. The Fossil watches are coming out.
Interesting. I stopped wearing watches after a while.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess as long as I don't go to an Apple Watch, then something like this might work. Actually, for a while, like I had a watch that I would just keep, it stopped working at some point, but I just kept wearing it because I was used to wearing a watch.
Right.
But
even Paul is right twice a day.
That's right. Until I stopped wearing the watch.
So, looking over this more, I think that the game is somehow playable in some way, because some of the photos of this show the screen entirely dark, or one shows the screen entirely dark, and one shows the screen mostly dark with just some stuff in the upper left corner, and the first image shows a lot of stuff going on. So, I think something does happen graphically with this thing, but how you control it and how well it plays, I have no idea.
Right, like, are you playing it, or are you looking at what looks like kind of the game playing itself, or what have you? But still, it's definitely neat. It's unlike, looks like there was also a Breakout watch. My goodness. Okay. Also by Fossil.
Yep. So they did some deal together. Like, let's make some.
We're called Fossil. You are a Fossil.
Yeah, I know. I was just thinking, like, it does seem like the name is perfect. Like,
right.
All right, cool. Well, I have things that are sort of mostly miscellaneous.
We were joking before that Paul has picked 160 eBay auctions.
This time I have only five here, they may not all require a lot of discussion. But one that came up, I forget exactly how this landed in my search, but it's a digital cart. It's a piece of furniture. It has, little wheels on the bottom and some shelves. But it is, in fact, a digital thing. Like, in fact, I think it's even in the catalogs. It's specifically for putting, digital equipment on, deck equipment, So, model MNC11HA.
Isn't this just like the Atari Fossil Watch? This is digital, trying to get their name out there, stay relevant.
Yep.
They go to some cart company and say, hey, it's a pretty cool digital branded cart.
But I did, I tracked, you know, like I dug around a little bit on this, and you know, you can find, this is like a part of a set, you know, if you're buying your digital stuff for your company, like you want to get this and the stuff and the, you know, the various things, that the monitor that goes on it and the little machine part that slides in. And so
I guess this is how you can have a portable VAX.
So I mean, at this point, I don't know, like I can see that when digital was a like an ongoing concern, I'm not exactly sure why you would want to buy this cart by itself unless you had everything but the cart already. But anyway, there it is.
It would be funny if the world had gone that way, if we were unable to make computers smaller and smaller and lighter and lighter, and instead we just stuck with huge computers and got just better and better carts.
Yep. It's like... the next thing, I don't really know. I don't know enough about the Intellivision to know when, like, if this is interesting or not. I think it is. It is the computer module for the Intellivision, and this comes in a box. It looks like, you know, the box is just a little bit beat up, but the stuff inside looks beautiful. It's got a little keyboard and a little computer adapter thing that you stick in the side of your Intellivision, I guess. It doesn't include the Intellivision. I think this just sticks in the side.
Right.
But, I don't think they're super common. So if you were interested in turning your Intellivision into a computer, I don't even have an Intellivision, but getting one of these would be the reason I would get an Intellivision, I think.
Right. It certainly wouldn't be the Intellivision controllers. Yeah. They would not be the reason to get an Intellivision.
Oh, was this
my thumb must feel too good.
Yeah, this was the one. This was the one with the disc controllers, right? The little circles.
Yeah. Actually, I saw recently. I was at this retro gathering thing here in Sweden a couple weeks ago, and I saw some people walk up to an Intellivision that was set up for display, and they were completely stymied by the controllers. They were like, did not understand at all how to use, they were even holding it up to their face as if it was a telephone. And I don't think they were even quite entirely joking, because they just like, they had no concept. They're like, what is this? How?
Is it like a Wii controller? Like you flail it around?
Well, that's it, because especially if you've ever used an original like iPod or whatever, you get that disc that just spins freely with your thumb on it, and it feels like, oh, is this a dial of some sort?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not.
It's an odd thing. But yeah, if you want a little computer, runs through an Intellivision, has 2K of RAM, I think they came with, then this thing can hook you up. You're right that the box is beat up. The stuff inside is like too clean to have been cleaned. It must have been inside this box unused. It is crazily clean.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
And I'm sure the keyboard is fun to use, too.
Yeah, look at that keyboard. Just you like, Carrington.
Oh, yeah, little square chiclet things. Sounds great.
And I think this added also some kind of extra audio capability to the Intellivision, if I remember right.
Brandine Bomber.
Nice. Yeah, there's on the back of the box, there's a little thing that says, add to the system, add to the fun, and it gives you some other things you can put in, and one of them, the first one, is a music synthesizer.
There you go.
Which actually looks like whatever that is, half keyboard, like half piano keyboard that you could plug into it if you have the computer module.
Right.
No, but the second thing you can add is the best, the system changer. That's my favorite.
Oh, it turns it into if you wish you had gotten an Atari.
Yeah, exactly. If you regret this purchase, why not add the system changer and turn this into a 2600?
Yeah. That seems pretty cool. I mean, I feel like I can't quite get into consoles I must draw a line. Somewhere there must be a line.
Or get a bigger office.
Exactly.
Right. That's right. The next thing is, so this is an Apple II card called the Scilab II. Not something I'd ever heard of, but it's kind of an interesting concept for a card. It's a random number generator. So you put this in your computer, and it will provide you sufficiently random numbers, which you couldn't have as easily gotten just on your computer itself.
It is hard to make random numbers on the Apple II.
Yeah.
First game I wrote for the Hackfest one of the things that stymied me for a while was trying to figure out how the heck do I get a – there's no clock in this thing. How do I get a random number?
Yeah.
I found it very difficult.
Well, and I think what the sort of built-in random number seed, I think, is based on the time that it takes you to hit a key.
Yeah, that's how I just did it manually. I figured, I'll just start a little counter going in the background and wait for somebody to do some input. But if you input really, really quickly, you just immediately hit return, you're just going to get the same number every time. So,
if you don't, like, you have to ask for keyboard input. You can't just, like, boot up and start doing something random because it's not going to be random. So...
But this was for, I guess, for ESP measuring?
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose if you're, you know, if you're going to trust your results, they have to be random. If you're going to see, if people really could, whatever that is, read the mind of the computer. I don't know what it is they were trying to do.
Wow, I could make a much cheaper and easier device to show whether or not people can do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very strange. There was, you know, actually there was... I'm trying to remember now. A software company called Avant-Garde. They did a bunch of stuff on the Apple II, but some of the weirder stuff that they did was like sort of like self-actualization software, things like this. And there was something where essentially like the way it was supposed to work was that it would wait for you to press a key, and that was gonna sort of like determine the fortune that it was gonna give you or something like that. But the theory behind it was that, you know, somehow the universe would move you to hit the key at the right point, you know, when the random number generator was in the right place. It's, I don't know, very strange stuff. But you can sort of tell by their name that was kind of like where they thought they were going. And then later on, they just like wrote like flight simulators and stuff. I don't know what, but they had a bunch of stuff, golf, and it was a fairly productive company. Although I don't think the software was very impressive ultimately. But anyway, so if you wanted to get real random numbers on your Apple II, you could get this card. The seller seems to have done some research into it. And is going to enclose a CD with all the information gathered from the internet on this board.
I guess the hard part isn't making a random number generator. It's making a good one. Because I can make one. Just like, I randomly choose the number 6 again. What were the odds? Again.
But, Yeah, I don't know. But, I mean, it's an interesting problem. And, you know, like it was something that needed to be solved in the 8-bit days. So... It is a starting bid of $39. I guess I didn't say any of the prices of anything so far, but whatever. Random. Yeah. The Intellivision computer module was $89 buy it now, and the cart was $122 buy it now, and that's even at 31% off. So,
ooh.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. The next thing, actually, this is a model TRS-80 Model 100 full setup with the digital video interface that has floppy drives in it, and a little security monitor. It actually appears to be amber, oddly. I didn't know that they came in amber, but it's a pretty cool little setup. It's not cheap, so they want a starting bid of $324, but you know, so this includes the Model 100, the DVI, and the monitor, and the connection. I think it's a home-built cable that connects them. Which, I don't know. I think we've talked about these a couple times, but the cable that connects the digital video interface to the Model 100 there's some property of how these wires go to the pins that makes this cable a nightmare to create on your own. Like, you know, every other thing has to go to the other side of the socket or something like this. Anyway, it's nice not to have to create the cable. But I think it's kind of cool because it's a somewhat unusual use of the Model 100. I mean, like the Model 100 being the, I assume people have a picture of this in their head, but it's like a little portable computer. It has something like 5x80 line LCD display.
Mm-hmm.
But,
and the idea of turning that into basically the keyboard for a desktop computer is neat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's, right. So essentially what you do is you just say like redirect the display through this digital video interface, and it has floppies that you can boot, and so yeah, it's kind of a neat thing, and the DVI things are semi rare. I'm looking at two of them on my desk, of course, but they're normally kind of hard to find.
So if you're going to attach it to this monitor and this box with the floppies and all that, it's kind of like that Intellivision computer monitor or module that turns it into a 2600. Like if you wish you didn't have what you got, this will turn it into something else. Like why have a Model 100 if you're going to weigh it down with 50 pounds of more desktop stuff?
Right. Well, and the thing is, actually, I don't think that the interface itself has anything but the, like, it has the disks and the circuitry to make the video go, but I don't think it gives you any extra, like, ROM slots or RAM. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but like, so it's not adding any power. But I guess it is adding disk drives. So, yeah. Although I think you can get at least 3.5-inch drives for this, can't you?
Oh, if you get 3.5-inch drives, you could make a notebook.
and now sort of thinking of the like the Flight of the Conchords camera phone or whatever. But anyway, it's interesting to see if you haven't seen it. And it's you know, it's a pretty complete set if you're interested in creating this thing. And the little security monitors actually often sell for quite a lot on their own. They were sort of the cheap thing in the past, but of course they don't, you know, you can't get them anymore, and they have this sort of iconic look to them. So anyway, the last thing I was going to mention was it just looked kind of cool. It's a TRS-80 space warp program, so it has a space warp tape and the letter-sized manual, which is probably just, you know, all of 2 pages long, but it looks sort of pleasingly blue and green and orange, and it's personal software too, who are the VisiCalc people, and in one of their game endeavors. And it's, you know, starting bid is $4.99, so you can afford it.
No, I can't, because it's got like $23 shipping to me.
Ooh, okay.
It's expensive. Sorry. For a cassette tape.
Yeah, I just got some cassette. What was that? Dancing Demon. Last time it was the one. It was the pick, and nobody bid on it. Well, I bought it. I gave everybody they had their chance. it ended, and nobody bid on it, and the price went down. And so I said, all right, well, heck with that. I'm bidding on it, and so it's coming.
Excellent.
And it's the same basic sort of setup as this. It's like, you know, some sort of like letter sized, probably not very involved manual. Although the manual for Dancing Demon, I think, also has some information of how you can create your own music for the demon to dance to. It's pretty cool. I'm trying to think if I even have anything I can run that on, though. Yeah, I do. I'll have to try that. If the computer works, I'll try it out. So, okay. I think that's it. That was all I had put down. So I feel like we're just, like, this is almost too short of a show, but anyway, whatever.
I disagree.
Okay. Anyway, so now I guess we're all ready to closing discussions. And so, Carrington, you have anything you wanted to end with?
I got nothing. I need to do more retro stuff. My life is empty.
Yeah. Yeah.
My problem is my life is too full. I don't have time I don't have time for my hobbies, and that is a sad state.
Yeah. I know the feeling. Yep. Jack, you have some success here to report.
Yeah, I did one thing. I went to the retro gathering event here in Sweden in Västerås a couple weeks ago, and that was a lot of fun. They had various contests. There was every year they have an annual Swedish mastership in Pong, and I participated in Pong, and I did not win. But that's okay.
Oh.
And they also had, this time they had Warlords, which I don't know if you guys know. It's a
great game.
4-player paddle game. Each person has one corner of the screen and has like a set of bricks behind them and a castle behind those bricks. And it's kind of like an inverse breakout. Like you're trying to defend your portion from everyone else. So I played that and didn't win that either. But they had another contest, which was useless trivia about celebrities doing endorsements for old computers and video games. So basically they would show they would give you a brand or a product, and then give you the faces of three celebrities, and you're supposed to pick which of these celebrities had done an ad for this thing. And, you know, so it could be like there was, what was it? I think Alan Greenspan had done an ad for the Apple IIc, and there was like, there was a whole bunch of these. I think there were like, there's like about 15 of these, I think. And you got 1 point if you guessed the, if you matched the face, like said, yeah, that's the person. And another point if you also knew the person's name. And I won.
Wow.
So that was cool.
Excellent.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I think I owe it all to having heard so many old ads on this and other shows.
Right.
Although a lot of them I recognized or I knew. Like, yeah, I remember. Like, yeah, like obviously in television, George Plimpton. Like, some of these are super easy to me, at least, because I guess I, you know, I grew up with this stuff. There were a few that I totally missed. Like, one was Bryan Cranston did an ad for some old video game, I think an Activision game in the early 80s, and I totally missed that.
Oh, I guess somebody else got that one.
So,
one of the big ones would be William Shatner for the VIC 20.
Yeah, I think they
the had, Wonder Computer of the 80s.
Yep, they had that, and they had Bill Cosby doing an ad for, was it?
The
EI-94A, yeah.
It's excellent. This would have been a good quiz show for Kevin Savitz to run at next year's Kansas Fest.
Yep.
Still might be, so study up.
Yep, yeah, wow. It was pretty good. Anyway, so I won, and the prize was a copy of The Art of Atari, this big coffee table book full
nice.
Of art.
Yeah,
cool.
That's good, because I've been meaning to buy this book and hadn't done it, and now the universe provided it for me.
You don't have to. The random number generator has spoken in your
That's
favor.
Right.
Yeah, I was like, when you said what the contest was, I thought, oh, okay, I've got this. But yeah. And Bryan Cranston and Alan Greenspan, I would have you would have beaten me on that for sure.
Well, those are two that I missed. That's why I remember them. Yeah. They stand out. Like, it's like, what? Really? Wow.
So I just looked up. It's Megaforce.
That's it.
Megaforce?
Bryan Cranston for Megaforce.
That was it.
Interesting. Yeah.
I don't remember who I guessed. I guessed somebody else entirely, but yep.
All right.
I would not have known that.
Yep.
Or the Greenspan one. So yeah, I too would have thought, oh, this will be easy. Nope.
Although I think maybe the listeners might actually have found it easy, since they will have already heard this.
That's right.
Yeah, this is true.
Because this is how we pick our ads. But well, cool. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's excellent. Let's see. For me, so I already talked a little bit about the like having gone to this MIT flea market thing. That's pretty cool. It happens every month during the sort of non-winter months, and I keep not going, but it's sometimes that I have seen things like TRS-80 Model 3 and, you know, some Apple IIs and stuff like that very, very occasionally, but most of the time when I go, it's just mainly, you know, Palm Pilots and, you know, 486s and stuff. But Halt and Catch Fire is ending. So the show about the show is about like all sorts of things, creation of Compaq, and I think it's most recently turned into creation of Yahoo, basically.
Yeah, I watched the first season of that, but then the very end of that show got like drama crazy, and I was like, what the heck, and the fire and all this, like, ugh, and I just never came back to it.
Yeah, I can't not watch it. I think is basically the conclusion, but it's now, I think, over for good. I mean, like, I haven't quite finished watching the last couple episodes, but they have aired, so. And there's a podcast called Welcome to Macintosh that has just, I think it may be the end of its second season or something, but they just have published something on Panic Software, which I thought that was pretty cool. I was sort of aware of this story, but Panic had sort of in the I don't know when it, since right now I'm looking at a little spinning beach ball, I can't find out when this was, but they had a program called Audion, which was like a MP3 player basically. It was very cool. I remember it from those days. And it one of the things that was coolest about it was you could sort of like make skins for it. Mm. And actually also it did some kind of like alpha channel stuff so that the skins did not need to be rectangles. So did you guys, either of you play with this program at all?
I remember it.
This rings a bell.
Vaguely.
This rings a bell.
Yeah. Because it was shareware first, if I recall, and then became a full thing. I think at the time I was using Soundjam. which is the thing that then got bought by Apple, I think, to make iTunes. So I think I was a SoundGen user instead at the time that Audion was a thing.
Yeah, I think so this is Cable and Steve made Panic Software, and also Steve, this is Steve Franks, I think, and Cable Sasser. But one of the things that Steve Franks did was had a little Beagle Brothers Museum page, too. Like, so I've always been sort of sympathetic to that company, just because, like, well, first of all, the software they make is cool. So I mean, like, I have used all of them. I was on a, you know, I bought Audion, I bought whatever it is, Transmit and Unison.
I still use Transmit. To this day, it is still one of my favorite FTP clients.
Mm-hmm. But so the story, basically the Audion story was that they almost became iTunes, but sort of like let that go by, and their competitor got bought by Apple to become the sort of underlying piece of iTunes. But so the Welcome to Macintosh episode is actually sort of talking about the story and talking to them, and there's kind of a cool little extra as well that has them running Audion on an emulator and finding the Easter eggs and stuff like that. It's interesting to listen to, and I'm kind of glad that this showed up, because it was, you know, the page that describes that story has been on their site forever, but I mean, like, it's like, I'm sure nobody looks at it anymore. So it's kind of neat to bring this back into consciousness. And I just, you know, it's a fun company with sort of like retro sympathetic people. Cable Sasser has done a fair amount of scanning of the DAC catalogs. I don't know if you guys remember the DAC catalogs or if you ever looked at them, but it was kind of like a reseller. Drew Allen Kaplan, I think, is the guy's name. And I don't know. If you haven't seen them, you should take a look at them. They're kind of kind of insane. It was basically this sort of like entrepreneurial guy who would like buy everybody's like overstock and then try to resell it, and in very sort of flowery language. So anyway, whatever. Take a look, listen to that podcast when you're done with this one. And
and I remain a big fan of Panic and their stuff as a company. I've been using their stuff for many, many, many years and still do. I guess Unison, actually. Unison on the Mac was my favorite
newsgroup.
Reader. Yes, Usenet Reader. It was like the thing that I still access all the time. Usenet. Yeah. Yes, Usenet Reader. I wish there was readers, write in. Is there a currently great Usenet browsing or using tool for OS X?
Well, I think it still works, right? I think Unison still...
Oh, sure, yeah. And it's become shareware again, which is totally awesome.
Yeah.
that they when they discontinue stuff, it says, not support anymore, now it's shareware. I think that's pretty cool. So, yeah, it still works. I still have it. But, you know, I think they essentially discontinued it a few years ago now. So how long is it for the world? And I may switch back to SoundJam now that I talked about it. I think I still have never liked iTunes as much as I like SoundJam. I think it was a step backwards.
Mm-hmm. Well, but it's kind of interesting. Like you can hear Panic's opinion of SoundJab in this podcast. You know, very bad user interface, and it's actually really funny. Definitely listen to this if you have a chance.
And it could be that if I checked out Audion, I'll realize I was, because I'm such a fan of Panic and all their software. Mm-hmm. Probably having not really used Audion, I didn't realize what I was missing out on when I was, you know, sullying my computer with SoundJam.
Right. Oh, well. Well, this is, you know, you can use it on all your emulated Macs. Right?
Excellent. So.
All right. So I guess that covers it. Anyone else have anything they wanted to say?
Nope. I know you desperately want the shows to be longer, but that's all we have, Paul.
Okay. All right. Well, then that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this show and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. Send feedback to us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And please write a review on iTunes, the ancestor of which is SoundJam, to help other people find the show and you know, inflate our egos. And now that I've totally ruined any kind of momentum that there is as we lead into this, until next time,
Retro-compute.
Okay.